The air was thick with psychic power of a nature I'd experienced once before back in the Wraith Deeps. That was when Lara Wraith had unleashed the full force of her come-hither against her own father, the White King, drowning his mind in imposed lust and desire to please her. He'd been her puppet ever since. This was the same form of attack, though there were subtle differences. It had to be Barrowill. He'd moved even faster than I'd feared. I kept my mental shields up as I picked up my pace. By the time I reached the fourth floor, I heard the noise the amiable Toker had mentioned. It was sex. Loud sex. A lot of it. I dropped the pizza and drew my blasting rod. It took me about 5 seconds to realize what was happening. Barrowill must have been pushing Connie, psychically, forcing her to continue feeding and feeding after she would normally have stopped. He wanted her to kill Erwin, like a good little vampire, and the overflow was spilling out into the entire building. Not that it takes much to make college kids interested in sex, but in this instance, they had literally gone wild. When I looked down the four hallways, doors were standing wide open, couples and, well, the only word that really applied was clusters of kids were in the act, some of them right out in the hall. Imagine an act of lust. It was going on in at least two of those four hallways. I turned down Erwin's hall, channeling my will into my blasting rod, and yes, I'm aware of the Freudian irony here. The carved runes along its length began to burn with silver and scarlet light as the power built up in it. A white court vampire is practically a pussycat compared to some of the other breeds on the planet, but I'd once seen one of them twist a pair of 50-pound steel dumbbells around one another to make a point. I might not have much time to throw down on Barrowill in these narrow quarters, and my best chance was to put him down hard the instant I saw him. I moved forward as silently as I knew how, stepping around a pair of couples who were breaking some sort of municipal statute, I was sure. Then I leaned back and kicked open the door to Erwin's room. The place looked like a small tornado had gone through it. Books and clothing and bedclothes and typical dorm room decor had been scattered everywhere. The chair next to a small study desk had been knocked over. A laptop computer lay on its side, showing what I'd once been told was a blue screen of death. The bed had fallen onto its side where two of the legs appeared to have snapped off. Connie and Erwin were there, and the haze of lust rolling off the ingenue succubus was a second psychic cyclone. I barely managed to push away. Erwin had her pinned against the wall in a corner. His muscles strained against his skin, and his breath came in dry, labored gasps, but he never stopped moving. He wasn't being gentle, and Connie apparently didn't mind. Her eyes were a shade of silver, metallic silver, as if they'd been made of chrome, reflecting the room around her like tiny, warped mirrors. She'd sunk her fingers into the drywall to the second knuckle on either side of her to hang on, and her body was rolling in a strained arch in time with his motion. They were gratuitously enthusiastic about the whole thing. And I hadn't gotten laid in forever. "Erwin!" I shouted. Shockingly, I didn't capture his attention. "Connie!" I didn't capture hers either. I couldn't let the process continue. I had no idea how long it might take or how resistant to harm Erwin might be, but it would be stupid to do nothing and hope for the best. While I was trying to figure out how to break it up before someone lost an eye, I heard the door of the room across the hall open behind me. The sights and sounds and the haze of psychic influence had my mental processes running at less than peak performance. I didn't process the sound into a threat until Barrowill slugged me on the back of the head with something that felt like a lump of solid ivory. I don't even remember hitting the floor. When I woke up, I had a Sasquatch-sized headache. My wrists and ankles were killing me. Half a dozen of Barrowill's goons were literally kneeling on me to hold me down, Every single one of them had a knife pressed close to one of my major arteries. Also, my pants had shrunk by several sizes. I was still in Irwin's dorm room, but things had changed. Irwin was on his back on the floor, Connie astride him. Her features had changed, shifted subtly. Her skin seemed to glow with pale light. Her eyes were empty white spheres. Her cheekbones stood out more harshly against her face, and her hair was a sweat-dampened, wild mane that clung to her cheeks and her parted lips. She was moving as if in slow motion, her fingernails digging into Irwin's chest. Barrowill's psychic assault was still underway, and Connie's presence had become something so vibrant and penetrating that for a second I thought there might have been a minor earthquake going on. I had to get to that girl. I had to. If I didn't, I was going to lose my mind with need. My instant reaction upon opening my eyes was to struggle to get closer to her on pure reflex. The goons held me down, and I screamed in protest. But at least being a captive, it kept me from doing something stupid and gave me an instant's cold realization that my shields were down. I threw them up again as hard as I could, but the barrel wheels had been in my head too long. I barely managed to grab hold of my reason. The kid looked awful. His eyes were glazed. He wasn't moving with Connie so much as his body was randomly shaking in independent spasms. His head lolled from one side to the other, and his mouth was open. A strand of drool ran from his mouth to the floor. Barrowill had righted the fallen chair. He sat upon it with one ankle resting on his other knee, his arms folded. His expression was detached, clinical, as he watched his daughter killing the young man she loved. "Barrowill," I said. My voice came out hoarse and rough. "Stop this." The vampire directed his gaze to me and shook his head. "It's after midnight, Dresden. It's time for Cinderella to return to her real life." "You son of a bitch," I snarled. "She's killing him." A small smile touched one corner of his mouth. "Yes, beautifully. Her hunger is quite strong." He made a vague gesture with one hand. "Does he seem upset about it? He's immortal, and mortals are all born to die. The only question is how and in how much pain." "There's this life thing that happens in between," I snarled. "And many more where his came from." Barrowill's eyes went chill. "His and yours." "What do you mean?" "When she's finished, we leave. Your dessert." A lump of ice settled in my stomach, and I swallowed. All things considered, I was becoming a little worried about the outcome of this situation. "Talk, Harry. Keep him talking. You've never met a vampire who didn't love the sound of his own voice. Something could change the situation if you play for time." "Why not do it before I woke up?" I asked. "This way is more efficient," Barrowill said. "If a young athlete takes ecstasy and his heart fails, there may be a candlelight vigil, but there won't be an investigation. Two dead men, one of them a private investigator, there will be questions." He shrugged a shoulder. "And I don't care for you to bequest me your death curse, wizard. But once Connie has you, you won't have enough left of your mind to speak your own name, much less utter a curse." "The wraiths are going to kill you if you drag the court and the council into direct opposition," I said.
"The wraiths will never know. I own 20 ghouls, Dresden, and they're always hungry. What they leave of your corpse won't fill a moist sponge."
Connie suddenly ceased moving altogether. Her skin had become pure ivory white. She shuddered, her breaths coming in ragged gasps. She tilted her head back, and a low, throaty moan came out of her throat. I've had sex that wasn't as good as Connie sounded. "Damn it, Dresden, focus." I was out of time.
"The council will find out, Chuck. They're wizards. Finding unfindable information is what they do."
He smirked.
"I think we both know that their reputation is very well constructed."
We
did both know that. Damn it.
You think nobody's going to miss me? I asked. I have friends, you know.
Farewell suddenly leaned forward, focusing on Connie, his eyes becoming a few shades lighter.
Perhaps, Dresden, but your friends are not here.
Then there was a crash so loud that it shook the building. Barrowill's sleek black Lincoln Town Car came crashing through the dorm room's door, taking a sizable portion of the wall with it. The ghouls holding me down were scattered by the debris, and fine dust filled the air. I started coughing at once, but I could see what had happened. The car had come through from the far side of this wing of the dorm, smashing through the room where Barrowill had waited in ambush. The car had crossed the hall and wound up with its bumper and front tires resting inside Irwin's room. It had smashed a massive hole in the outer brick wall of the building, leaving it gaping open to the night. That got everyone's attention. For an instant, the room was perfectly silent and perfectly still. The ghoul chauffeur still sat in the driver's seat, only his head wobbled loosely, leaning at a right angle to the rest of his neck.
"Ha!" I cackled, wheezing. "Ah! Ah! Moron!"
A large figure leapt up to the hole in the exterior wall and landed in the room across the hall, hitting with a crunch only slightly less massive than the car had made. I swear to you, if I'd heard that sound effect they used to use when Steve Austin jumped somewhere, I would not have been shocked. The other room was unlit, and the newcomer was a massive, threatening shadow. He slapped a hand the size of a big cookie tray on the floor and let out a low, rumbling sound like nothing I'd ever heard this side of an amplified bass guitar. It was music. You couldn't have written it in musical notation any more than you could write the music of a thunderstorm or write lyrics to the song of a running stream, but it was music nonetheless. Power, like nothing I had ever encountered, surged out from that impact, a deep, shuddering wave that passed visibly through the dust in the air. The ceiling and the walls and the floor sang in resonance with the note and impact alike, and Barrowill's psychic assault was swept away like a sandcastle before the tide. Connie's eyes flooded with color, changing from pure, empty whiteness back to a rich blue as deep and rich as a glacial lake, and the humanity came flooding back into her features. A sense of wild panic in the air suddenly vanished, and for another timeless instant, everything, everything in that night went utterly silent and still. Holy crap. I've worked with magic for decades. And take it from me, it really isn't very different from anything else in life. When you work with magic, you rapidly realize that it is far easier to disrupt than to create. Far more difficult to mend than to destroy. Throw a stone into a glass, smooth lake, and ripples will wash over the whole thing. Making waves with magic instead of a rock would have been easy. But if you make that lake smooth again, that's one hell of a trick. That surge of energy didn't attack anything or anybody. It didn't destroy Barrowill's assault. It made the water smooth again. Strength of a river in his shoulders opened his eyes, and his fury made them burn like coals in the shadows. But he simply crouched, doing nothing. All of Barrowill's goons remained still, wide eyes flicking from river to Barrowill and back. "Back off, Chuck," I said. "He's giving you a chance to walk away. Take him up on it." The vampire's expression was completely blank as he stood among the debris. He stared at River Shoulders for maybe 3 seconds, and then I saw movement behind River Shoulders. Clawed hands began to grip the edges of the hole behind River. Wicked, bulging red eyes appeared. Monstrous-looking things in the same general shape as a human appeared in complete silence. Ghouls. Barrowill didn't have 6 goons with him. He'd brought them all. Barrowill spat toward River, bared his teeth, and screamed, "Kill it!"
And it was on. Everything went completely insane. The human-shaped ghouls in the room bounded forward, their faces and limbs contorting, tearing their way out of their cheap suits as they assumed their true forms. More ghouls poured in through the hole in the wall like a swarm of panicked roaches. I couldn't get an accurate count of the enemy. The action was too fast. But 20 sounded about right. 20 flesh-rending, superhumanly strong and durable predators flung themselves onto River's shoulders in an overwhelming wave. He vanished beneath a couple of tons of hungry ghoul. It was not a fair fight. Barrowill should have brought more goons. There was an enormous bellow, a sound that could only have been made by a truly massive set of lungs, and ghouls exploded outward from River's shoulders, like so much hideous shrapnel. Several were flung back out of the building. Others slammed into walls with so much force that they shattered the drywall. One of them went through the ceiling, then fell limply back down into the room, only to be caught by the neck in one of River's shoulders' massive hands. He squeezed, crushing the ghoul's neck like soft clay, and there was an audible pop. The ghoul spasmed once, then River flung the corpse into the nearest batch of monsters. After that, it was clobbering time. Barrowill moved fast, seizing Connie and darting out the door. I looked around frantically and spotted one of the knives the goons had been holding before they transformed. My hands and ankles had been bound in those plastic restraining strips, and I could barely feel my fingers, but I managed to pick up the knife and cut my legs free. Then I put it on the front bumper of the Lincoln, stepped on it with one foot to hold it in place, and after a few moments managed to cut my hands loose as well. The dorm sounded like a medley of pay-per-view wrestling and the Island of Dr. Moreau. Ghouls shrieked. River shoulders roared. Very, very disoriented students screamed. The walls and floor shook with impact again and again as River shoulders flung ghouls around like so many softballs. Ghoulish blood spattered the walls and the ceiling, green, brown, and putrid smelling, and as strong as he was, River shoulders wasn't pitching a shutout. The ghoul's claws and fangs had sunk into him, covering him in punctures and lacerations, and his scarlet blood mixed with theirs on the various surfaces. I tried to think unobstructive thoughts, stayed low, and went to Erwin. He still looked awful, but he was breathing hard and steady, and he'd already begun blinking and trying to focus his eyes. "Erwin!" I shouted. "Erwin, where's her purse?"
"What's that?" Erwin mumbled.
"Connie's purse! I've got to help Connie! Where's her purse?"
Erwin's eyes almost focused.
"Connie?
Oh, never mind." I started ransacking the dorm room until I found Connie's handbag. She had a brush in it. The brush was liberally festooned with her blonde hairs. I swept a circle into the dust on the floor, tied the hair around my pentacle amulet, and invested the circle with a whisper of will. Then I quickly worked the tracking spell that was generally my bread and butter when I was doing investigator stuff. When I released the magic, it rushed down into Connie's borrowed hair, and my amulet lurched sharply out of plumb and held itself steady at a 30 or 40 degree angle. Connie went that away. I ducked a flying ghoul, leapt over a dying ghoul, and staggered down the hall at my best speed while the blood went back into my feet. I had gone down one whole flight of stairs without falling when the angle on the amulet changed again. Barrowill had gone down one floor, then taken off down one of the residential hallways toward the fire escape at the far end. He'd bypassed security by ripping the door off its hinges, then flinging it into the opposite wall. Kids were scattering out of the hallway, looking either horrified or disappointed. Some both. Barrowill had reached the far end, carrying his daughter over one shoulder, and was headed for the fire door. Barrowill had been savvy enough to divest me of my accoutrements, but I was still a wizard, dammit, blasting rod or no. I drew up my will, aimed low, and snarled, "Forsari!" Pure kinetic force lashed invisibly through the air and caught Barrowill at the ankles. It kicked both of his feet up into the air, and he took a pratfall onto the floor.
Connie landed with a grunt and bounced to one side. She lay there dazed and blinking. Barrowill slithered back up to his feet, spinning toward me, and produced a pistol in one hand. I lurched back out of the line of fire as the gun barked twice and bullets went by me with a double hiss. I went to my knees and bobbed my head out into the hall again for a quick peek, jerking it back immediately. Barrowill was picking Connie up. His bullet went through the air where my head would have been if I'd been standing.
"Don't be a moron, Harry," I said. "You came for the kid. He's safe. That's all you were obligated to do. Let it go." Oh, who am I kidding? There's a girl.
I didn't have to beat the vampire. I just had to slow him down long enough for River's shoulders to catch up to him, assuming River did pursue. I took note of which wing Barrowill was fleeing through and rushed down the stairs to the ground level. Then I left the building and sprinted to the far end of that wing. Barrowill slammed the emergency exit open and emerged from the building. He was moving fast, but he also had his daughter to carry, and she'd begun to resist him, kicking and thrashing, slowing him down. She tugged him off balance just as he shot at me again, and it went wide. I slashed at him with another surge of force, but this time I wasn't aiming for his feet. I went for the gun. The weapon leapt out of his hands and went spinning away, shattering against the bricks of the dorm's outer wall. Another blast knocked Connie off his shoulder, and she let out a little shriek. Barrowill staggered, then let out a snarl of frustration and charged me at a speed worthy of the Flash's understudy. I flung more force at him, but Barrowill bobbed to one side, evading the blast. I threw myself away from the vampire and managed to roll with the punch he sent at my head. He caught me an inch or two over one eyebrow, the hardest and most impact-resistant portion of the human skull. That, and the fact that I'd managed to rob it of a little of its power, meant that he only sent me spinning wildly away, my vision completely obscured by pain and little silver stars. He was furious, his power rolling over me like a sudden deluge of ice water, to the point where crystals of frost formed on my clothing. Barrowill followed up, his eyes murderous, and then Bigfoot Irwin bellowed, "Connie!" and slammed into Barrowill at the hip, using his body as a living spear. Barrowill was flung to one side, and Irwin pressed his advantage, still screaming, coming down atop the vampire and pounding him with both fists in elemental violence, his sunken eyes mad with rage.
"Connie! Connie!"
I tried to rise, but couldn't seem to make it past one knee. So all I could do was watch as the furious scion of River Shoulders unleashed everything he had on a ranking noble of the White Court. Barrowill could have been much stronger than a human being if he'd had the gas in the tank. But he'd spent his energy on his psychic assault, and it had drained him. He still thrashed powerfully, but he was no match for the enraged young man. Irwin slammed Barrowill's nose flat against his face. I saw one of the vampire's teeth go flying into the night air. Slightly too pale blood began to splash against Irwin's fists. Christ, if the kid killed Barrowill, the White Court would consider it an act of war. All kinds of horrible things could unfold.
"Irwin!" I shouted. "Irwin, stop!"
Kid Bigfoot didn't listen to me. I lurched closer to him, but only made it about 6 inches before my head whirled so badly that I fell onto my side.
"Irwin, stop!"
I looked around and saw Connie staring dazedly at the struggle.
"Connie!" I said. "Stop him! Stop him!"
Meanwhile, Irwin had beaten Barrowill to within an inch of his life, and now he raised his joined hands over his head, preparing for a sledgehammer blow to Barrowill's skull. A pretty, small hand touched his wrist.
"Irwin," Connie said gently.
"Irwin?"
"No."
"He tried," Irwin panted. "Tried hurt you."
"This isn't the way," Connie said.
"Bad man," Irwin growled.
"But you aren't," Connie said, her voice very soft. "Irwin, he's still my daddy."
Connie couldn't have physically stopped Irwin, but she didn't need to. The kid blinked several times, then looked at her.
He slowly lowered his hands, and Connie leaned down to kiss his forehead gently.
Shh, she said.
Shh, I'm still here. It's over, baby. It's over.
Connie,
Irwin said and leaned against her. I let out a huge sigh of relief and sank back onto the ground. My head hurt.
Officer Dean stared at me for a while. He chewed on a toothpick and squinted at me. Got some holes.
Yeah,
I asked.
Like what?
Like all those kids saw Bigfoot and them whatchamacallits ghouls. How come they didn't say anything? You walked in on them while they were all still trying to put their clothes back on, after flinging themselves into random sex with whoever happened to be close to them. They're all denying that this ever happened right now.
Dean said.
What about the ghoul corpses? After Irwin dragged their boss up to the fight, the ghouls quit when they saw him. River Shoulders told them all to get out of his sight and take their dead with them. They did.
Dean squinted and consulted a list.
Pounda is gone, so is Connie Barrowill. Not officially missing or nothing, not yet. But where are they?
I looked at Dean and shrugged.
I'd seen ghouls in all kinds of situations before, but I'd never seen them whipped into submission. Ghouls fought to the grisly, messy end. That was what they did. But River Shoulders had been more than their match. He'd left several of them alive when he could have killed them to the last, and he'd found their breaking point when Irwin had dragged Barrowill in by his hair. Ghouls could take a huge beating, but River Shoulders had given them one like I'd never seen. And when he ordered them to take their master and their dead and never to return, they'd snap to it.
Thanks, Connie,
I groaned as she settled me onto a section of convenient rubble. I was freezing. The frost on my clothes was rapidly melting away, but the chill had settled inward. The girl looked acutely embarrassed, but that wasn't in short supply in that dorm. That hallway was empty of other students for the moment, though. We had the place to ourselves, though I judged that the authorities would arrive in some form before long. Irwin came over with a dust-covered blanket and wrapped it around her. He'd scrounged a ragged towel for himself, though it did more to emphasize his physique than to hide it. The kid was ripped.
Thank you, Irwin, she said.
He grunted. Physically, he bounced back from the nearly lethal feeding like a rubber-freaking ball. Maybe River Shoulders' water-smoothing spell had done something to help that. Mentally, he was slowly refocusing. You could see the gleam coming back into his eyes. Until that happened, he'd listened to Connie. A guy could do worse.
Connie shook her head. I remember all of it, but I have no idea what just happened.
She stared at River Shoulders for a moment, her expression more curious than fearful.
You stopped something bad from happening, I think.
Yeah, he did, I confirmed. Connie nodded toward him with a grateful little motion.
Thank you. Who are you?
Irwin's dad, I said. Irwin blinked several times. He stared blankly at River Shoulders.
Hello, River rumbled.
How something that large and that powerful could sit there bleeding from dozens of wounds and somehow look sheepish was beyond me.
I am very sorry we had to meet like that. I had hoped for something quieter, maybe with music and good food.
You can't stay, I said to River. The authorities are on the way. River made a rumbling sound of agreement.
This is a disaster. What I did...
He shook his head.
This was in such awful taste.
Couldn't have happened to nicer guys, though, I said.
Wait, Connie said. Wait. What the hell just happened here?
Irwin put a hand on her shoulder and said to me,
She's a vampire, isn't she?
I blinked and nodded at him.
How did...
Perronet, he said. There's a whole page.
Wait, Connie said again. A what? Am I going to sparkle or something?
God, no, said Irwin and I together.
Connie,
I said, and she looked at me. You're still exactly who you were this morning, and so is Irwin. And that's what counts. But right now, things are going to get really complicated if the cops walk in and start asking you questions. Better if they just never knew you were here.
This is also...
She shook her head, then she stared at River Shoulders, then at me.
Who are you?
I pointed at me and said, Wizard. I pointed at River. Bigfoot. I pointed at Irwin. Son of Bigfoot. I pointed at her. Vampire. Seriously.
Oh,
she said faintly. I'll explain it, Irwin told her quietly. He was watching River's shoulders. River held out his huge hands to either side and shrugged. Hello, son. Irwin shook his head slowly. I never really... He sucked in a deep breath, squared off against his father, and said, Why? And there it was. What had to be the big question of Irwin's life. My people, he said. Tradition is very important to them. If I acknowledged you, they would have insisted that certain traditions be observed. It would have consumed your life. And I didn't want that for you. I didn't want that for your mother. I wanted your world to be wider than mine. Bigfoot Irwin was silent for a long moment. Then he scratched at his head with one hand and shrugged. Tonight really explains a lot. He nodded slowly. Okay. We aren't done talking, but okay. Let's get you out of here, River said. Get you both taken care of. Answer all your questions. What about Harry? Irwin said. I couldn't get any more involved with the evident abduction of a scion of the White Court. River's mercy had probably kept the situation from going completely to hell, but I wasn't going to drag the White Council's baggage into the situation. You guys go on, I told them. I do this kind of thing all the time. I'll be fine. Wow, seriously? Irwin asked. Yeah, I said. I've been in messier situations than this, and it's probably better if Connie's dad has time to cool off before you guys talk again. River Shoulders can make sure you have that time. Outside, a cart with flashing bulbs on it had pulled up. River, I said, time's up. River Shoulders rose and nodded deeply to me. I'm sorry that I interfered. It seemed necessary. I'm willing to overlook it, I said, all things considered. His face twisted into a very human-looking smile, and he extended his arm to Irwin. Son. Irwin took his father's hand, one arm still around Connie, and the three of them didn't vanish so much as just become less and less relevant to the situation. It happened over the course of 2 or 3 seconds, as that same nebulous, somehow transparent power that River had used earlier enfolded them. And then they were all gone. Boots crunched down the hall, and a uniformed officer with a name tag reading Dean burst in, one hand on his gun. Dean eyed me, then said, That's all you know, huh? That's the truth, I said. I told you that you wouldn't believe it. You gonna let me go now? Oh, hell no, Dean said. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. You're stoned out of your mind or insane. Either way, I'm gonna put you in the drunk tank until you have a chance to sleep it off. You got any aspirin? I asked. Sure, he said and got up to get it. My head ached horribly, and I was pretty sure I hadn't heard the end of this, but I was clear for now. Next time, Dresden, I muttered to myself, just take the gold. Then Officer Dean put me in a nice quiet cell with a nice quiet cot, and there I stayed until Wild Bill Myers showed up the next morning and bailed me out.
Bombshells. This next story got written in that glorious time between the end of Changes and the beginning of Ghost Story, when fans were regularly screaming at me for answers, and when I could regularly give answers that were somehow worse than the original questions. I realized, however, that I had agreed to several short stories in this same time period when Dresden was or was not actually dead, which would make it something of a challenge to cast him as a protagonist of tales set during the same period. The natural thing to do was to shift to the viewpoint of other characters and to have a chance to show the impact of Dresden's absence on some of the characters who had been closest to him. In this case, I got the chance to write about life from the point of view of his apprentice, Molly, and how Dresden's apparent death had affected many of the people in his circle. But more important, about how Dresden's life had affected those same people and how it would show in their choices.
I miss my boss. It's been most of a year since I helped him die, and ever since then I've been the only professional wizard in the city of Chicago. Well, okay, I'm not, like, officially a wizard. I'm still sort of an apprentice, and no one really pays me, unless you count the wallets and valuables I lift from bodies sometimes, so I guess I'm more amateur than professional. And I don't have a PI license like my boss did, or an ad in the phone book. But I'm all there is. I'm not as strong as he was, and I'm not as good as he was. I'm just going to have to be enough. So anyway, there I was, washing the blood off in Waldo Butters' shower. I did a lot of living outdoors these days, which didn't seem nearly as horrible during the summer and early autumn as it did during the Arctic chill of the previous super winter. It was like sleeping on a tropical beach by comparison. Still, I missed things such as regular access to plumbing, and Waldo let me clean up whenever I needed to. I had the shower heat turned all the way up, and it was heaven. It was kind of a scourgy, scoury heaven, but heaven nonetheless. The floor of the shower turned red for a few seconds, then faded to pink for a while as I sluiced the blood off. It wasn't mine. A gang of Fomor servitors had been carrying a 15-year-old boy down an alley toward Lake Michigan. If they'd gotten him there, he'd have been facing a fate worse than death. I intervened, but that bastard Listen cut his throat rather than give him up. I tried to save him while Listen and his buddies ran. I failed. And I'd been right there with him, feeling everything he did, feeling his confusion and pain and terror as he died. Harry wouldn't have felt that. Harry would have saved the day. He would have smashed the Fomor goons around like bowling pins, picked the kid up like some kind of serial movie action hero, and taken him to safety. I missed my boss. I used a lot of soap. I probably cried. I had begun ignoring tears months ago, and at times I honestly didn't know when they were falling. Once I was clean, physically anyway, I just stood there soaking up the heat, letting the water course all over me. The scar on my leg where I'd been shot was still wrinkled, but the color had changed from purple and red to angry pink. Butters said it would be gone in a couple of years. I was walking normally again, unless I pushed myself too hard. But yikes, my legs and various pieces needed to get reacquainted with a razor, even with medium blonde hair. I was going to ignore them, but grooming is important for keeping one's spirits up. A well-kept body for a well-kept mind and all that. I wasn't a fool. I knew I wasn't exactly flying level lately. My morale needed all the boost it could get. I leaned out of the shower and swiped Andy's pink plastic razor. I'd pay Waldo's werewolf girlfriend back for it later. I wrapped up about the same time as the hot water ran out, got out of the shower, and toweled off. My things were in a pile by the door. Some garage sale Birkenstocks, an old nylon hiker's backpack, and my bloodied clothes. Another set gone. And the sandals had left partial tracks in blood at the scene, so I'd have to get rid of them, too. I was going to hit another thrift store at this rate. Normally, that would have cheered me up, but shopping just wasn't what it used to be. I was carefully going over the tub and floor for fallen hairs and so on when someone knocked. I didn't stop scanning the floor. In my line of work, people can and will do awful things to you with discarded bits of your body. Not cleaning up after yourself is like asking for someone to boil your blood from 20 blocks away. No, thank you. Yes, I called. Hey, Molly, Waldo said. There's someone here to talk to you. We'd prearranged a lot of things. If he'd used the word feeling at any point in his sentence, I would have known there was trouble outside the door. Not using it meant that there wasn't, or that he couldn't see it. I slipped on my bracelets and my ring and set both of my wands down where I could snatch them up instantly. Only then did I start putting clothes on. Who? I called. He was working hard not to sound nervous around me. I appreciated the effort. It was sweet. Says her name is Justine. Says you know her. I did know Justine. She was a thrall of the vampires of the White Court, or at least a personal assistant to one and the girlfriend of another. Harry always thought well of her, though he was a big, goofy idiot when it came to women who might show the potential to become damsels in distress. But if he were here, I muttered to myself, he'd help her. I didn't wipe the steam off the mirror before I left the bathroom. I didn't want to look at anything in there. Justine was a handful of years older than me, but her hair had turned pure white. She was a knockout, one of those girls all the boys assume are too pretty to approach. She had on jeans and a button-down shirt several sizes too large for her. The shirt was Thomas's, I was certain. Her body language was poised, very neutral. Justine was as good at hiding her emotions as anyone I'd ever seen, but I could sense leashed tension and quiet fear beneath the calm surface. I'm a wizard, or damned close to it, and I work with the mind. People don't really get to hide things from me. If Justine was afraid, it was because she feared for Thomas. If she'd come to me for help, it was because she couldn't get help from the White Court. We could have had a polite conversation that led up to that revelation, but I had less and less patience for the pleasantries lately, so I cut to the chase. Hello, Justine. Why should I help you with Thomas when his own family won't? Justine's eyes bugged out. So did Waldo's. I was getting used to that reaction. How did you know? Justine asked quietly. When you're into magic, people always assume anything you do must be connected to it. Harry always thought that was funny. To him, magic was just one more set of tools that the mind could use to solve problems. The mind was the more important part of that pairing. Does that matter? She frowned and looked away from me. She shook her head. He's missing. I know he left on some kind of errand for Lara, but she says she doesn't know anything about it. She's lying. She's a vampire. And you didn't answer my first question. The words came out a little harsher and harder than they'd sounded in my head. I tried to relax a little. I folded my arms and leaned against a wall. Why should I help you? It's not like I wasn't planning to help her, but I knew a secret about Harry and Thomas few others did. I had to know if Justine knew the secret too, or if I'd have to keep it hidden around her. Justine met my eyes with hers for a moment. The look was penetrating. If you can't go to family for help, she said, who can you turn to? I averted my eyes before it could turn into an actual soul gaze, but her words and the cumulative impression of her posture, her presence, her self, answered the question for me. She knew. Thomas and Harry were half-brothers. She'd have gone to Harry for help if he were alive. I was the only thing vaguely like an heir to his power around these parts, and she hoped I would be willing to step into his shoes, his huge, stompy, terrifying shoes. You go to friends, I said quietly. I'll need something of Thomas's. Hair or fingernail clippings would be... She produced a Ziploc plastic bag from the breast pocket of the shirt and offered it to me without a word. I went over and picked it up. It had a number of dark hairs in it. You're sure they're his? Justine gestured toward her own snow-white mane. It's not like they're easy to confuse. I looked up to find Butters watching me silently from the other side of the room. He was a beaky little guy, wiry and quick. His hair had been electrocuted and then frozen that way. His eyes were steady and worried. He cut up corpses for the government, professionally, but he was one of the more savvy people in town when it came to the supernatural. What? I asked him. He considered his words before he spoke, less because he was afraid of me than because he cared about not hurting my feelings. That was the reverse of most people these days. Is this something you should get involved in, Molly? What he really wanted to ask me was if I was sane, if I was going to help or just make things a lot worse. I don't know, I said honestly. I looked at Justine and said, wait here. Then I got my stuff, took the hairs, and left. The first thing Harry Dresden ever taught me about magic was a tracking spell. It's a simple principle, kid, he told me. We're creating a link between two similar things out of energy. Then we make the energy give us an indicator of some kind, so that we can tell which way it's flowing. What are we going to find? I asked. He held up a rather thick gray hair and nodded back toward his dog, Mouse. He should have been named Moose. The giant, shaggy temple dog was pony-sized. Mouse, Harry said. Go get lost and we'll see if we can find you. The big dog yawned and padded agreeably toward the door. Harry let him out and then came over to sit down next to me. We were in his living room. A couple nights before, I had thrown myself at him. Naked. And he'd dumped a pitcher of ice water over my head. I was still mortified, but he was probably right. It was the right thing for him to do. He always did the right thing, even if it meant he lost out. I still wanted to be with him so much, but maybe the time wasn't right yet. That was okay. I could be patient. And I still got to be with him in a different way almost every day. All right, I said when he sat back down. What do I do? In the years since that day, the spell had become routine. I'd used it to find lost people, secret places, missing socks, and generally to poke my nose where it probably didn't belong. Harry would have said that went with the territory of being a wizard. Harry was right. I stopped in the alley outside Butters's apartment and sketched a circle on the concrete with a small piece of pink chalk. I closed the circle with a tiny effort of will, drew out one of the hairs from the plastic bag, and held it up. I focused the energy of the spell, bringing its different elements together in my head. When we'd started, Harry had let me use four different objects, teaching me how to attach ideas to them, to represent the different pieces of the spell. But that kind of thing wasn't necessary. Magic all happens inside the head of the wizard. You can use props to make things simpler, and in truly complex spells, they make the difference between impossible and merely almost impossible. For this one, though, I didn't need the props anymore. I gathered the different pieces of the spell in my head, linked them together, infused them with a moderate effort of will, and then, with a murmured word, released that energy down into the hair in my fingers. Then I popped the hair into my mouth, broke the chalk circle with a brush of my foot, and rose. Harry always used an object as the indicator for his tracking spells, his amulet, a compass, or some kind of pendulum. I hadn't wanted to hurt his feelings, but that kind of thing really wasn't necessary. I could feel the magic coursing through the hair, making my lips tingle gently. I got out a cheap little plastic compass and a 10-foot length of chalk line. I set it up and snapped it to mark out magnetic north. Then I took the free end of the line and turned slowly until the tingling sensation was centered on my lips. Lips are extremely sensitive parts of the body generally, and I've found that they give you the best tactile feedback for this sort of thing. Once I knew which direction Thomas was, I oriented the chalk line that way, made sure it was tight, and snapped it again, resulting in an extremely elongated V shape, like the tip of a giant needle. I measured the distance at the base of the V. Then I turned 90 degrees, walked 500 paces, and repeated the process. Promise me you won't tell my high school math teacher about it, but after that, I sat down and applied trigonometry to real life. The math wasn't hard. I had the two angles measured against magnetic north. I had the distance between them in units of Molly paces. Molly paces aren't terribly scientific, but for purposes of this particular application, they were practical enough to calculate the distance to Thomas. Using such simple tools, I couldn't get a measurement precise enough to know which door to kick down, but I now knew that he was relatively nearby, within 4 or 5 miles, as opposed to being at the North Pole or something. I move around the city a lot, because a moving target is a lot harder to hit. I probably covered 3 or 4 times that on an average day. I'd have to get a lot closer before I could pinpoint his location any more precisely than that, so I turned my lips toward the tingle and started walking. Thomas was in a small office building on a big lot. The building was 3 stories, not huge, though it sat amid several much larger structures. The lot it stood upon was big enough to hold something a lot bigger. Instead, most of it was landscaped into a manicured lawn and garden, complete with water features and a very small, very modest wrought iron fence. The building itself showed a lot of stone and marble in its design, and it had more class in its cornices than the towers nearby had in their whole structures. It was gorgeous, and understated at the same time. On that block, it looked like a single, small, perfect diamond being displayed amid giant jars of rhinestones. There were no signs outside it. There was no obvious way in, beyond a set of gates guarded by competent-looking men in dark suits. Expensive dark suits. If the guards could afford to wear those to work, it meant that whoever owned that building had money. Serious money. I circled the building to be sure, and felt the tingling energy of the tracking spell confirming Thomas's location. But even though I'd been careful to stay on the far side of the street, someone inside noticed me. I could feel one guard's eyes tracking me, even behind his sunglasses. Maybe I should have done the initial approach under a veil, but Harry had always been against using magic except when it was truly necessary, and it was way too easy to start using it for every little thing if you let yourself. In some ways, I'm better at the how of magic than Harry was, but I've come to learn that I might never be as smart as him when it came to the why. I went into a nearby Starbucks and got myself a cup of liquid life and started thinking about how to get in. My tongue was telling me all about what great judgment I had when I sensed the presence of supernatural power rapidly coming nearer. I didn't panic. Panic gets you killed. Instead, I turned smoothly on one heel and slipped into a short hallway leading to a small restroom. I went inside, shut the door behind me, and drew my wands from my hip pocket. I checked the energy level on my bracelets. Both of them were ready to go. My rings were all full up, too, which was about as ideal as things could get. So, I ordered my thoughts, made a small effort of will, whispered a word, and vanished. Veils were complex magic, but I had a knack for them. Becoming truly and completely invisible was a real pain in the neck. Passing light completely through you was a literal stone-cold bitch because it left you freezing cold and blind as a bat to boot. Becoming unseen, though, was a different proposition entirely. A good veil would reduce your visibility to little more than a few flickers in the air, to a few vague shadows where they shouldn't be, but it did more than that. It created a sense of ordinariness in the air around you, an aura of boring unremarkability that you usually only felt in a job you didn't like around 3:30 in the afternoon. Once you combined that suggestion with a greatly reduced visible profile, remaining unnoticed was at least as easy as breathing. As I vanished into that veil, I also called up an image, another combination of illusion and suggestion. This one was simple. Me, as I'd appeared in the mirror a moment before, clean and seemingly perky and toting a fresh cup of creamy goodness. The sensation that went with it was just a kind of heavy dose of me, the sound of my steps and movement, the scent of Butters's shampoo, the aroma of my cup of coffee. I tied the image to one of the rings on my fingers and left it there, drawing from the energy I'd stored in a moonstone. Then I turned around, with my image layered over my actual body like a suit made of light, and walked out of the coffee shop. Once outside, the evasion was a simple maneuver, the way all the good ones are. My image turned left, and I turned right. To anyone watching, A young woman had just come out of the store and gone sauntering down the street with her coffee. She was obviously enjoying her day. I'd put a little extra bounce and sway into the image's movements to make her that much more noticeable, and therefore a better distraction. She'd go on walking down that street for a mile or more before she simply vanished. Meanwhile, the real me moved silently into an alleyway and watched. My image hadn't gone 100 yards before a man in a black turtleneck sweater, a servitor of the Fomor, stepped out of an alley and began following it. Those jerks were everywhere these days, like roaches, only more disgusting and harder to kill. Only, that was just too easy. One servitor wouldn't have set my instinct alarms to jingling. They were strong, fast, and tough, sure, but no more so than any number of creatures. They didn't possess mounds of magical power. If they had, the Fomor would never have let them leave in the first place. Something else was out there. Something that had wanted me to be distracted, watching the apparent servitor follow the apparent Molly. And if something knew me well enough to set up this sort of diversion to ensnare my attention, then it knew me well enough to find me, even beneath my veil. There were a really limited number of people who could do that. I slipped my hand into my nylon backpack and drew out my knife, the M9 bayonet my brother had brought home from Afghanistan. I drew the heavy blade out, closed my eyes, and turned quickly with the knife in one hand and my coffee in the other. I flicked the lid off the coffee with my thumb and slewed the liquid into a wide arc at about chest level. I heard a gasp and oriented on it, opened my eyes, and stepped toward the source of the sound, driving the knife into the air before me at slightly higher than the level of my own heart. The steel of the blade suddenly erupted with a coruscation of light as it pierced a veil that hung in the air only inches away from me. I stepped forward rapidly through the veil, pushing the point of the knife before me toward the suddenly revealed form behind the veil. She was a woman, taller than me, dressed in ragged, coffee-stained clothes, but with her long, fiery autumn hair unbound and wind-tossed. She twisted to one side, off balance, until her shoulders touched the brick wall of the alley. I did not relent, driving the blade toward her throat until, at the last second, one pale, slender hand snapped up and grasped my wrist, quick as a serpent, but stronger and colder. My face wound up only a few inches from hers as I put the heel of one hand against the knife and leaned against it slightly, enough to push against her strength, but not enough to throw me off balance if she made a quick move. She was lean and lovely, even in the rags, with wide, oblique green eyes and perfect bone structure that could be found only in a half dozen supermodels, and in every single one of the she. "Hello, Auntie," I said in a level voice. "It isn't nice to sneak up behind me, especially lately." She held my weight off of her with one arm, though it wasn't easy for her. There was a quality of strain to her melodic voice. "Child," she breathed, "you anticipated my approach. Had I not stopped thee, thou wouldst have driven cold iron into my flesh, causing me agonies untold. Thou wouldst have spilled my life's blood upon the ground." Her eyes widened. "Thou wouldst have killed me." "I wouldst," I agreed pleasantly. Her mouth spread into a wide smile, and her teeth were daintily pointed. "I have taught thee well." Then she twisted with a lithe and fluid grace away from the blade and to her feet a good long step away from me. I watched her and lowered the knife, but I didn't put it away. "I don't have time for lessons right now, Auntie Leah. I am not here to teach thee, child. I don't have time for games either. Nor did I come to play with thee," the Lenanshi said, "but to give thee warning, thou art not safe here." I quirked an eyebrow at her. "Wow, gosh." She tilted her head at me in reproof, and her mouth thinned. Her eyes moved past me to look down the alley, and she shot a quick glance behind her. Her expression changed. She didn't quite lose the smug superiority that always colored her features, but she toned it down a good deal, and she lowered her voice. "Thou makest jests, child, but thou art in grave peril, as am I. We should not linger here. She shifted her eyes to mine. If thou dost wish to brace this foe, if thou wouldst recover my godson's brother, there are things I must tell thee. I narrowed my eyes. Harry's fairy godmother had taken over as my mentor when Harry died, but she wasn't exactly